Part 2. A week after the game, Republican presidential candidate George Bush came to the Midland-Odessa area for a campaign appearance. The scene on the tarmac at the airport wasn't as feverish as the one at the parking lot of Ratliff Stadium, where Permian fans have been lined up for two nights to buy tickets. Some things, after all, would always be more important than others. But it did have the aura of a Friday morning pep rally. Shortly before noon, the parking lot outside the South Terminal was filled with people carrying cardboard signs that read, "Midland Loves Bush," or "Mojo Loves Bush." There were little boys dressed in white shirts and blue ties, and high school girls wearing lovely red velvet dresses with white shoes. There were baby strollers decorated with American flags. And there was a whole bus full of kids from Midland Baptist Temple School, the girls in red dress uniforms that went to the knee, and the boys in blue ties and red cardigan sleeveless sweaters that made them look grandfatherly. There was a smattering of people in cowboy hats, and a man in a Phillips 66 cap, and another man who wore a military-style cap that said, "Brazos Valley War Games." When he took it off during the rally to put on a free one that said Bush Quail 88, he didn't look any different. Cheerleaders from Midland High milled about in their uniforms, which made them look a little like old-fashioned movie ushers, and in the middle of it all sat a red Mercedes convertible with a paper sign taped to the side, "Lee Homecoming Duchesses Welcome Home George and Barbara Bush." There were almost no blacks or Hispanics in the audience. There were no signs of poverty, no signs of homelessness, no signs of drug abuse, no signs of the social fissures that were tearing apart America's urban centers to the east and west. The country was perfect and unblemished on this day. As the crowd eagerly awaited the arrival of Air Force Two, it snacked on the free hot dogs and cups of Coke that were neatly laid out on long picnic tables, sprinkled with brimming bowls of mustard and onions. Everything was neat and orderly. Everything you could have wanted was there. As the time drew near, the Midland High and Midland Lee bands moved past a fence onto the runway. The Midland High band played "Deep in the Heart of Texas," then "Come a Little Bit Closer," to the accompaniment of hundreds of little American flags bobbing up and down. The cheerleaders erupted into a spontaneous little cheer of, "Midland High, yeah, Midland High." And then Air Force Two came into view. "There he is, the next president of the United States," said the MC of the rally. "Let's go. We want George. We want George. We want George. We want George. Come on, West Texas, louder. We want George. We want George." The excitement was in part due to Bush's being something of a native son. After his graduation from Yale, he and his wife had moved to Odessa, where Bush worked as a salesman and clerk for an oil field supply company. They lived in Odessa for about a year in a little shotgun house on 7th Street that was next to a whorehouse. They became quite popular, which could perhaps be attributed to their down-home personalities or to the fact they had one of the few working indoor toilets on the street. Bush had then moved to Midland, where he got into the independent oil business and lived there for about 10 years. Many in the audience were there because they considered Bush's visit a kind of proud homecoming. His visit a claim to fame to an area of the country that most people had to look up in an atlas to find out where the hell it was. But beyond all that, there was something in the air, an outpouring that seemed unusually powerful, almost desperate. The Lee and Midland High bands both broke into "Deep in the Heart of Texas." Bush, wearing a blue suit, stepped off the plane onto the gangplank, and for the briefest of moments looked like Notre Dame coach Lou Holtz coming home after leading the Irish to a national championship. He started waving. In return, all the little American flags and the handmade signs started bobbing up and down again. By the standards of the national press, Bush said virtually nothing to those gathered at the airport in Midland, Texas, It was simply another campaign stop, another orchestrated moment. The only difference, as one correspondent wearily put it, was that this particular rally had two high school bands instead of one playing at full throttle. Bush's speech contained nothing newsworthy about drug policy or Nicaragua or the Federal Reserve or balancing the budget or social ills or the homeless. But no one cared. They weren't there to listen about problems. Bush said everything. Everything that the people assembled at the airport wanted to hear. So tired had they grown of the litany of how American education was failing, how the Japanese were taking over, how America couldn't compete anymore, couldn't feed its own anymore, wasn't strong anymore, just wasn't any damn good anymore. In his simple remarks, he confirmed for them that America was still great, still number one in the weekly top 20 poll, whatever the threat of the Japanese and the Germans and OPEC. He also confirmed for them that what they believed in, what they cared about, was the very essence of what it meant to be an American. It took almost no time for him to get his astonishingly simple message across. I believe that I am on the side of the American people and the state of Texas in terms of values. The crowd erupted in cheers, and the cheers only intensified as he listed some of those values. Prayer in the schools, the right to own a gun, the outrageousness of furloughing dangerous prisoners, particularly dangerous-looking black ones like Willie Horton. He took out the dreaded L word and planted it squarely on the forehead of his opponent, Michael Dukakis. Now, I am not going to be deterred by one or two liberal columnists or the liberal governor of Massachusetts. The word came out with a sneering nastiness, as though he were spitting out a rancid piece of food, and it successfully conveyed the desired effect. Being a liberal wasn't just a political state of mind, but was something threatening, something dangerous. Texas is on the way back! It was an absolutely mystifying statement, given the precipitous drop in oil prices at that very moment, and news the same week that yet another Texas bank, M Corp, had announced that it would not go on unless it received a $1 billion bailout from the FDIC. The announcement meant that 9 of the state's 10 largest banking organizations now needed an aggregate sum of money from public and private sources well into the tens of billions to stay afloat. The problems of M Corp and the other banks were nothing, of course, compared to the S&L crisis, which, according to one estimate, was going to take $65 billion to solve. But it didn't matter. People liked hearing that Texas was back, that they were tough and could take it, and were up on their feet again. Fact and fiction merged. They liked George Bush in the same way they absolutely worshipped Ronald Reagan, not because of the type of America that Reagan had actually created for them, but because of the type of America he had so vividly imagined. As Tony Chavez pointed out, it was an amazing illusion, as contradictory as Reagan himself becoming the great promoter of the family, despite his own life as a divorcee and a father whose children hated him. As contradictory as Bush's passing himself off as a down-to-earth Texan, despite an upbringing in the ultra-rich ozone of Greenwich, Connecticut, followed by sojourns at the equally elite Andover and Yale. There were more cheers, more frantic wavings of tiny flags. Thank you for the magnificent welcome home. I'm glad to be back. God bless you. The two bands once again broke into Deep in the Heart of Texas. The 500 or so people who had come out for the 5-minute speech then left to go home, happy and satisfied. In that brief interplay, it was easy to see why the election was over. Dukakis, with his painfully methodical low-key approach, didn't have a prayer. Bush then left to give a speech at the Petroleum Museum to an audience of independent oilmen. He talked about his time in Midland and his wife Barbara's world record as the mother that watched the most Little League games. He talked about a community pulling together in the 50s when times were not simply tough, but pretty darn tough. Mostly, he talked about values, the most important buzzword to be added to the lexicon of American politics in the 1988 election. "My values have not changed a bit since I was your neighbor in the 50s. My values are values like everyone here that I think of. Faith, family, and freedom. Love of country and hope for the future. Texas values. Some just call it just plain common sense. I am an optimist, and I'd much rather go around the United States of America talking about how things are on the move and that we can do better than in telling everybody how sad everything is, because my faith in this country has never varied since I learned from many of you what it is to take a risk and build something and to get out there and do something for the community. I've stood shoulder to shoulder with many people here today in starting the first YMCA in Midland, Texas, and then let that liberal governor ridicule me about 1,000 points of light. But it is neighbor helping neighbor. It is community. And Odessa and Midland stand for community. And we are right." It was the same thing he had done at the airport. He created an image of a country that was still as good, as fundamentally sound as it had been in the 50s, when Bush and thousands of others had watched the American dream blossom before their shining, ever-hopeful eyes. Days when the United States produced 44% of the world's oil, when the most dominant force affecting price was the Texas Railroad Commission and not OPEC, since there was no OPEC. Days of heaven that no longer existed. Their belief in him seemed ironic, perhaps even crazy. Far from blossoming, the economy of Midland-Odessa had fallen apart during the Reagan-Bush administration, and it was hard to think of any other single area of the country that had suffered as much. The price of oil had plummeted, and there were theories that this had happened because of an orchestrated maneuver by the Reagan administration, in concert with the Saudis, to reduce oil prices as a way of stimulating economic growth. If that was true, Bush was part of an administration that, far from protecting the oil industry, had pulled the rug out from under it. The estimated drop in spot oil prices in 1986 from about $24 a barrel to $8 a barrel resulted in a savings to consumers nationwide of about $200 million a day. With a 2.5% drop in the consumer price index, everyone around the country had a great deal more money to spend, except in Midland, Odessa, and other oil-producing regions where life under the Reagan-Bush administration became as bleak as it had been during the Depression. The statistics were numbing. In 1986, unemployment in Odessa shot up to 20%. The number of bankruptcies filed with the federal court in Midland went up by 65%. The price of housing in the Midland-Odessa area fell the most of any area in the nation, 11.4%. More gripping than the statistics were the images. Hundreds of people waiting outside the Permian Bank in Odessa after it had failed to see if they could get their money out. A row of once proud oil field workers who never in their lives had dreamed of applying for unemployment, stretching down the block like a bread line. An FDIC auction featuring the complete inventory of a failed Toyota dealership, 14 mobile homes and more than 150 cars and trucks, a full-page newspaper ad by Fannie Mae advertising great deals on 68 houses that were in foreclosure, not the lavish palaces that everyone associated with the Texas oil boom, but starter homes bought by people trying to grab a piece of the dream. And yet, when it came to the election, none of the devastation seemed to matter. "The Republicans have done nothing to help the Texas oil man for the last 8 years," said Clayton Williams, a Midland oil man. "But when it comes down to voting for a liberal versus a conservative, most oil men are conservative. If other oil men are like me, they're probably going to bitch and scream and moan and then go ahead and vote our principles. Conservative. Voting on principles was hardly a new phenomenon, but it seemed to go a step further in 1988. In Odessa and Midland, as in other places, liberalism had come to be perceived not as a political belief, but as something unpatriotic and anti-American, something that threatened the very soul of the hard-working whites who had built this country and made it great. And Dukakis, by the very way he looked and acted, embodied every bad stereotype of a liberal. Brooding, clenched, frowning, swarthy, hairy. A man who came across as one gigantic furrowed eyebrow. As election day neared in Odessa, the antagonism toward Dukakis and all that he represented became more and more venomous. Ever since the college was built for the Pennsylvania Methodists in the 1880s, there had been nothing but distrust for Yankees in Odessa. And Dukakis was as Yankee as they came, from Massachusetts, or Taxachusetts, as it was derisively called, with a Harvard background, surrounded by Harvard people who all spoke high and mighty Yankee talk and treated simple, earnest people like the citizens of Odessa with as much respect as they did the hind rear of a donkey. The tone of the comments and the campaign literature about him went far beyond simple dislike for a presidential candidate, because he was a Democrat. Even the jokes about him seemed bitterly cruel. What do Dukakis and pantyhose have in common? They both irritate Bush. What's 12 inches long and hangs in front of an asshole? Dukakis's necktie. During the election season, a so-called Michael Dukakis fact sheet started making the rounds in Odessa. The pamphlet, drawn up by a group called the League of Prayer in Montgomery, Alabama, and handed out at a local doctor's office, brutally condemned Dukakis as a pro-choice, pro-homosexual advocate of sodomy, who was soft on defense and soft on criminals, and who sought to rid America of its godly heritage. The pamphlet described him as a card-carrying member of the ACLU, which it said was the equivalent of being against everything moral, ethical, righteous, holy, Christian, godly, and patriotic. Homosexuals, the pamphlet said, were nothing more than a minuscule band of sexual perverts. In the Permian locker room, players old enough to vote for the first time talked about Dukakis as the homo president, and depicted a world with him as president in which it would no longer be possible to exercise the inalienable right of taking a .44 Magnum to blow the brains out of a criminal robbing or physically assaulting you. The comments about him depicted a man who would not simply take the country in a different direction, but would threaten its very sanctity, its very core. They translated into an almost irrational fear that Dukakis would shut down the military, fear that he would take away the right of people to protect themselves against violent intruders, fear that he would ruin the economy, fear that the only people who would benefit from his administration would be the poor, while they, the hard-working guts of the country, got sold down the river. Boy, I think he would be the worst thing that could ever happen to this country, said City Councilman Dub Kennedy, who found Dukakis's membership in the ACLU abhorrent. I think he's the biggest liberal I know running for president, said Ken Skates, who had lived in West Texas for almost 40 years and had built up his own oil field service company from scratch. All I know is what I have read in Reader's Digest and other things. I think he's too liberal. He'd shut the military down. Inflation would be bad. The only person that I see voting for him are other liberals and welfare recipients. First of all, I'm a gun collector, said former city councilman Vern Foreman. You tell me I can't have any guns, you're going to see hell of a fight. I don't see how anybody could vote for Dukakis. The son of a bitch is too damn liberal. Certainly, it would have been hard for Dukakis ever to play well in this part of the country. West Texas had a history of staunch conservatism, not to mention a virulent dislike of government as practiced by Democrats. In the 50s and 60s, the John Birch Society had a